This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Kevin Munger, assistant professor of political science and social data analytics at Penn State University. We are discussing his insightful book, Generation Gap, Why the Baby Boomers Still Dominate American Politics and Culture, from Columbia University Press. Generation Gap is one of the best books I've read all year, due largely to its simplicity and clarity. Generational divides and conflicts are constantly the subject of vitriolic debate. Generation Gap leads with data, showcasing how demographic trends and historical circumstances have contributed to generational polarization. Kevin, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Caleb, great to be here. Thanks for the kind introduction and looking forward to chatting.
Likewise, you know, this is a really fascinating book. I think such a relevant book. And, you know, before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you chose to write it.
Sure. Yeah. I have been doing research on social media and politics for a few years now, ever since I started grad school. And in the wake of the 2016 presidential election in the U.S., there was a lot of attention paid to the topic of misinformation. And when people were kind of scrambling to figure out what that was about, the fact that older people were much more susceptible to misinformation, more likely to encounter it, more likely to share it, really jumps out of the data. And as I began to look into that more, I just saw more and more evidence that there is a unique situation in the U.S. today in terms of our age and generational makeup that has implications for a wide range of political and cultural outcomes that people care about. I think in most of my research and most social science research, it tends to be more and more policy focused these days. So people are looking for specific pot problems and solutions. And that's great, but it does restrict the temporal scope of a lot of research. And so something like generations, which the cause of the dominance of the baby boomers today is first and foremost the fact that a lot of them were born 65 years ago, which is not something that's particularly amenable to a policy change today, but which does structure a lot of the fundamental conflicts that we are seeing playing out. So I think this is a useful, you know, perspective. It doesn't offer any easy solutions, but hopefully we'll have people thinking about more specific generationally relevant problems.
So, you know, the most prominent generations today are, as you mentioned, the baby boomers, also Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z. Without having to, like, go, you know, through the whole, you know, go over all the details of, like, what makes these generations unique, could you give listeners just, like, a slight overview of the different sort of baby makeups of these generations? What distinguishes them from typical generations?
Sure. So first, a slight correction. Gen X is not important. They need to get over that fact, and they have ceded all of their potential influence in culture because of their embrace of the dropout slacker identity. And I say that mostly because many of my colleagues are Gen X, and they they tend to get a bit
shots fired.
Yeah. Right. Well, so the intergenerational sniping is clearly part of this discussion. And while I don't think it's irrelevant, it is sometimes used to diminish the fundamental importance of generations. And I do think that there are serious material differences across these generations, which means that they are legitimate objects of social scientific inquiry. So beginning with the baby boomers, my favorite fact here is that Time Magazine awarded this entire generation their Person of the Year award in 1965, I believe, just for being born. So the award goes to the inheritors, people who were born into an unprecedented era of economic security and cultural possibility. And this lengthy article goes on to explain that the possibilities for the boomers are endless, that they are going to inherit a truly unique set of circumstances, and that they should thus go on to be the most important generation, most distinctive generation in American history. And I think that is broadly correct. So first of all, there are simply more of them, as I said earlier. The economic conditions are crucial for their ability to establish themselves in the workforce, establish families, become settled, establish communities. And the institutional context into which they were coming of age meant that all of these major institutions which govern the country today, govern broadly construed, like academia, the major professions, lawyers, doctors, media, were all really growing in this period when the boomers were coming of age. And so this one specific generation is still in power, thanks also to the democratization of old age. So the fact that more and more people are able to live into healthy old age has benefited the boomers first. I mean, it's a great thing. That's progress across the board. But it has meant that the boomers are winning both at the beginning and the end of the life cycle. Skipping over Gen X, millennials are the second largest generation after the boomers. They were first called the Echo Boomers. So before the millennial term emerged, the fact was that we were defined in opposition to this largest and most important generation. And so this conflict has been sort of baked in from the start. The stark contrast comes from the fact that millennials had quite poor economic conditions, beginning with the 2008 financial crisis, which really stunted our emergence into the workforce and thus delayed a lot of these traditional milestones of maturation, from owning a home to starting a career to being married, having children. And so this period of extended adolescence has really characterized the millennial generation, our inability to make headway in the institutions which are still dominated by the boomers, even as many millennials are now entering our 40s, continues to define this generation that is, I think, the most frustrated by the boomers. And Gen Z has really only started to emerge, looking at the Google Trends data on this, since I started writing the book, in fact. So there were simply not enough of them who are over 18 for Gen Z to be a definite useful category of adults. But now we're starting to see them as the first generation to be fully raised online. And I think this offers a different set of challenges and opportunities. In particular, I think in areas where new media technology is able to disrupt existing institutions, Gen Z is making rapid headway, but it is far more difficult still for them to enter into traditional institutional power. And in terms of an affective divide between millennials and Gen Z, I would, and this is kind of just cultural commentary, it's not provable or anything, it seems like millennials thought that we were entering a world of promise and that we have had our high expectations somewhat disappointed, whereas Gen Z never had any illusions to that effect and have been raised in a period of cynicism and sort of acceptance that the world is not going to play out in their favor. So that's my summary.
Yeah, I think that that's a great summary. And, you know, I agree with most of your characterization and your funny characterization of Gen X. I think I'm like sort of on the cusp of Gen Z and millennial. So I don't really, Gen Z, the younger Gen Z kind of terrifies me, the internet savviness, which I'm sure we'll get into later. And then also I think some of the, the anger, frustration that millennials maybe have towards the boomer generation is a little alien to me. And I also think in my generation, too, just not the same sort of frustration because, I was in middle school when the economic downturn happened. So I wasn't really about to enter the workforce, but mm-hmm. I think that that was a really interesting characterization of millennials. The idea that you talk about in the book that I really found to be the most fascinating, and I think is one that, people should talk about as a kind of irrelevant notion, is this concept of boomer ballast. And I was wondering if you could describe this idea about how it is or why it is that you believe that the baby boomer generation's influence will only grow stronger in the next few years.
Right. So the first thing I learned when trying to write a book is that you want to have a theory that can be summarized in two words, preferably alliterative. So I've come up with boomer ballast as what I hope is a memorable but not purely normative term. So I'm not trying to paint the boomers are as either inherently good or bad, but I am trying to draw attention to the fact that they have disproportionate power now and have throughout their life cycle. And so the idea of ballast today means, so explaining the metaphor briefly, a ship or a hot air balloon has ballast. It's the weight that is put at the bottom of the vessel in order to give it more stability. And it's not the case that you want to have minimum or maximum ballast. It has to be a balance. And so a trade-off when deciding on the amount of ballast is, do you want more stability or do you want the ability to change direction more quickly? And so more ballast means more stability, but more rigidity, less flexibility. And I think that today, the boomer's disproportionate power, boomer ballast, means that compared to how things would be developing, our society is unusually stable. That is, it is still unusually defined by this generation in terms of their cultural attachments, their preferences over policy, and their approach to technology. So looking at the demographic reality, next year, 2023, will be the single year in all of American history where the most people turn 65, the traditional age of retirement. And so on dimensions that are driven primarily by demand, so politics, we live in a democracy, and the demand in a democracy is who's voting, who's participating in primaries and other elements of political activism. The boomers will only become more relevant in this domain, as they have a windfall of free time and a kind of unprecedented degree of affluence and health with which to enjoy it. This is also the case for a lot of cultural domains and traditional cultural institutions. So although things don't necessarily seem super stable right now, my argument is that our society would have adapted much more quickly to, and much more fundamentally, to the possibilities of the internet if it were not so demographically top-heavy at present. And we see this most distinctly in terms of the makeup of Congress. We have the oldest House of Representatives in history, the oldest Senate in history, and the oldest president in history today. We also, cross-nationally, have the second oldest legislature in the world. So both by historical and comparative perspectives, our government is extremely old.
What are the promises and perils of demographic analysis for understanding the future of politics? You mentioned a little bit that as boomers age and have more free time, this will shift their influence on politics. At the same time too, even though sometimes people say that, older people are more conservative, I thought the boomers are the hippies, so shouldn't they be more progressive? Like, what do you see as the effect that aging will have on the future of politics and demography?
So first, the boomers were the hippies. The hippies were always a minority, a loud minority. Second, the hippies have all sold out. Well, I think what's very distinctive about that generation is because the economic circumstances were so good, people could genuinely be hippies, live a free, enviable life in their 20s, and then in their 30s decide, okay, I'm going to get a job and I'll be able to buy a house. So there wasn't really as much of a penalty for that kind of experimentation. But then when they did decide to adopt more mainstream mores, they were able to, and it did largely affect their politics in traditional ways. When people own a home, have children, especially women, they tend to become more conservative. In terms of the promises, I think that it is necessary for some things. I think to a huge extent, countries and particularly democracies are people. That a country is the people in that country. And older people are different from younger people. I think there is some hesitancy to imply anything except that everyone is the same, and for understandable reasons. There's lots of kind of fundamental liberal value is the equality of all people. And I think that's true, but people are not equal throughout their life. If anybody reflects on their own life, they can reflect on how different they are in capacities, in liabilities, in power today versus how they were in the past and how they can't expect to be in the future. So I think that this liberal normative moral commitment has to some extent disguised one of the fundamental truths of human existence, that we age, that we age is a defining feature of how we experience the world. And in terms of perils, I think that there are problems with making deterministic predictions about, for example, I mean, a very prominent one now is that as the country becomes more Hispanic in particular over the next few decades, this will be a automatic advantage for the Democrats, who have traditionally enjoyed more support among Hispanics than among white people. But that could easily change. These are not definite groups. And so making these kind of demographic assumptions is often deeply mistaken. The one case where I think it is not mistaken is when it comes to things like accounting. And so Social Security, we've known for a very long time that because of the math involved in how many people are working versus how many people are retired, Social Security will run out of money in sometime in the early 2030s. And at that point, in order to solve the problem, they'll either have to cut benefits to retired people, which is not going to happen, or they will have to raise taxes on the workers, on people currently working. The latter is going to happen, and this will represent a explicit intergenerational transfer from boomers who were not paying enough when they were working to boomers from millennials and younger generations who will still be in the workforce.
Another thing that you discuss about the boomers is how they were such an overwhelmingly or are such an overwhelmingly white generation. Can you talk about this identity of whiteness and its relationship to boomers?
Absolutely. So in the cultural imagination, I feel like there is an idea of boomers as white people, sort of a stereotype, but it is to a, I thought, surprising extent true. So for a few reasons, I believe it is accurate to say, although the demographic data from long in the past is not super reliable, that the boomers are the whitest generation in American history. The primary reason for this has to do with changing patterns of immigration. So the long-term percentage for at least 150 years, the U.S. population has been 15%, 13%, around that range, foreign-born for that entire time period. The exception is in the 1920s, 30s, the U.S. begins to become much more restrictive in terms of immigration, and particularly implementing racial exclusion quotas and only allowing people from certain European countries to continue to immigrate. So this means the 1950s, when most of the boomers were children, is the period in American history where there are the fewest foreign-born citizens. That number has since come back, and so in the baby boomers' lifetimes, the percentage of foreign-born Americans has tripled, which is a pretty significant change. The other side of this coin, in terms of the definition of whiteness, is that this category is, of course, constructed and has not been stable over time. So other racialized ethnic groups like Jews, Italians, Irish, and others were in the period before the boomers in early 20th century, 19th century, not really considered white. They still had this racialized status. And as those groups became more integrated in society, it became broadly correct. And today we certainly do call those groups white. And so for these two reasons, it seems plausible to me to say that the boomers are the whitest generation in American history.
Speaking on the boomers and just their choice of media, you know, what they consume, the world that they live in, you describe how media will likely change with the eventual passing of the boomers. What do you see as the sort of the future of media, especially mainstream media, that today caters to the baby boomer generation?
Well, the idea of mainstream media is a fundamentally boomer concept. I think this is mostly because of the media technology. So the broadcast era that defines our imagination, the mid-20th century of media, was a historical anomaly where we have, because of the economics and regulations of those media technologies, very few producers and broadcasters. And so the idea of a mainstream media only really makes sense in the broadcast era. Today, I think although social media is becoming much, much more important, for many politically relevant outcomes, television, cable television, and broadcast news are still more important for those outcomes. That's really the central point for media discourse. But the audience for television news is incredibly age skewed. So very few people under 50 watch cable news at all. And yet it is the primary source of news for the boomer generation. So although it is still so focal, I think that there will not necessarily be a replacement. Instead, the millennial and Gen Z media consumption habits, social media first, much more fragmented, will take over, and that will be the world that we inherit. Now, there still will be superstars and like the fame of very popular social media influencers, streamers, etc., is on the same level as cable news hosts. But in terms of the centralization and lack of competition that defined the mainstream media, that I think is going away.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard, You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is more of a philosophical question, but it's one that you touch on in your book. What constitutes generational identity? You know, where does it come from?
Right. Well, the origins of identity are quite complicated. But the problem of generations is first really articulated by the German sociologist Karl Mannheim in his influential paper of the same name. And he's really describing the generations around the early 20th century and what creates this sense of generational belonging. So it's not really enough that you share a birth date with someone. A prince and a pauper, even if they're born in the same year, have very different experience in the world. And as Mannheim says, they have different locations. So he was primarily concerned with class, which I think is still a very relevant location for how people experience the world. There are many other such locations. And Mannheim says that it's only in the context of shared locations when there is either a shared physical presence, a shared experience of the world, and then geographic proximity, do we see the emergence of generational consciousness. I think today social media offers an alternative, which makes the geographic proximity experience much less relevant. And instead, the shared location is where people encounter each other, which for younger generations is increasingly online. So people define their experience of the world through their experience of media. And so I think, for example, the idea of a generation as a 15 to 18 year long unit is making less and less sense as the media world inhabited by smaller and smaller slices of demographic time become more and more distinct. So the people who grew up watching the exact same influencers and seeing the same internet trends become the cultural touchstones for these micro generations, which are able to define themselves against both the younger and the older with more specificity. And because geography is no longer a constraint, they are able to encounter millions of their fellow generationalists in a way that wouldn't really have been possible, except in very broad strokes, things like going to college or going to Vietnam for the boomers.
What issues do you think that younger generations, the millennials and Gen Z, what issues will they face that are similar to previous generations?
Every generation's experience of the world is somewhat different. But in terms of the other conception of the word generation, we think of this as parents and children are two different generations. And in this frame, it is perhaps the most constant thing in human existence, the fact of the old people raise the young people in that they give birth to them and they raise them. And then the intergenerational transmission of culture and values, and then the fundamental need for younger generations to move past older generations and the conflict that emerges from the battles over tradition versus progress are certainly going to continue. So that fundamental element of human, the cyclical nature of our existence will continue and be the same for millennials and Gen Z and everyone else.
This is maybe more of a question less related to what you discuss, but maybe to other notions of generations like that you might find in like the fourth turning or things like that, of this idea of generations operating on these sort of cycles where every four generations, the next subsequent generation resembles the first generation of the earlier cycle. What do you make of these ideas, these theories? Are these, more so, like on the equivalent of like astrological projections?
Perhaps, which is to say that people find them useful to explain the world. That doesn't, I don't think necessarily right or wrong. I'm not convinced necessarily that this is a fundamental pattern that always has to exist. I mean, that I suppose will be discovered as the predictions from that framework are tested as time passes. Yeah, I guess I don't really think about the generations in those terms very often. I think there are other features of our economy and our society and our culture which have cyclical components, and those certainly intersect with how generations experience the world. So that does mean that every generation is different, but also the same, and that there's echoes of current experiences in the past. But I don't find that framework particularly useful myself.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, your approach compared to those approaches feels much more based on what the data says, as opposed to a neat framework that puts a generation in some holy position to overturn things. And I think that, you know, there is this sort of idea about Gen Z. I don't exactly know where it comes from, that Gen Z will be some transformative generation, or maybe the generation after Gen Z will be some transformative generation. So I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about, you know, the issues that younger generations face, and what you see as driving their development, and maybe what their political views will become like once they enter, adulthood.
Sure. I mean, there aren't that many generations, so, you know, you can pick one, predict that'll be the transformative one, and you've got a pretty decent chance of being right. I think that what I find most distinctive about Gen Z is that they are the first generation that really is able to consume media that is created for, by, and about themselves. So thinking back to this idea of intergenerational contact and transmission of culture and values, in earlier media regimes, this was done face-to-face, either through parents and children, extended families, or institutions like schools who played the role of bringing up the next generation in the world that the adults already lived in. With broadcast media, we have that cultural transmission to some extent being, that role being overtaken by the media. But even then, the people creating the media for young people were older people. So there's a continuity there in the broadcast era. And so what I think is distinct about social media, and especially social media which uses audiovisuals, which is the dominant media format, the preferred media format for the majority of people, and in many ways the most powerful media format. So this audiovisual content for, by, and about Gen Z makes possible a sort of radical short-circuiting of this traditional continuity and the transmission of culture and values, which I think does create the conditions for a much higher variance in terms of how Gen Z experiences and thinks about the world.
Do you have any optimism for the future of generational cooperation? Your book covers so much of generational conflict, but do you see a future where maybe millennials and baby boomers can form some sort of a truce? Well, you don't have to predict the future, but...
No, I mean, there's going to be some breaking point when the number of baby boomers becomes who are retired, but still active and participating in politics and culture, will present novel forms, like novel challenges. And so today I think that American culture, compared to many other cultures, is so focused on progress that we have kind of a blind spot when it comes to old age. To a large extent, I think this is to our shame. We would prefer not to acknowledge that old age exists. Our preferred response is to just try to transcend it through every possible bodily modification, health regime, or to shut it away and to put older people in distinct communities where we can try to get rid of them. But this simply will not work given the time scales and the sheer numbers. And so when the increased need of caregiving for baby boomers becomes more obvious, you know, my hope is that this can produce more intergenerational contact as younger people, more and more young people will need to take care of older people. I'm hoping that this can produce some, you know, greater understanding of our shared experiences rather than in a purely mediatized world. The experiences really are so distinct that it makes empathy pretty challenging.
I think that that's a nice, you know, that would be something like that would be very nice if there was more generational contact. And I think that definitely does seem to be the case that the, you know, younger generation and older generation just don't have as much contact as they maybe would have in the past. You know, I was wondering if there's, because generations is talked about all the time, if there are any pitfalls of thinking about generations that you would caution people about, and maybe if there's a way of thinking about generations that still acknowledges their relevance, but also doesn't turn them into, you know, the pivotal thing on which history turns. Any ways in which you would tell our listeners to think or not think about generations?
So this is funny. I've done a couple of these interviews, and the intuitions of my interlocutor differs dramatically onto people's expectations of the relevance of generations by generation. So I think younger people find the argument I'm making extremely intuitive, almost obvious, that generations are important. Older people, by and large, do not. And so I have, given that I'm an academic working in an industry still dominated by older people, I find that I'm often fighting the opposite battle, which is people's intuitions are that generations are media trivialities or are made up by advertisers to sell products. And I think that, so there, you know, if I had to rank identities, generations is not the most important one, not by a long shot, not as important for American politics as race or gender or partisanship, but it is still a crucial way that people experience the world. I think what's so confounding about it compared to some of those other identities, which people acknowledge as important, is that generations are necessarily changing over time. And so how a generation is, you know, people experience the same things growing up if they're in the same generation, but they experience different things. And so what a generation is can change over time. And so it's much more fluid than, say, race or gender in terms of the status throughout a person's life cycle.
No, I think that's a really interesting observation, and certainly one that I haven't thought about the view that generations to certain generations matter more to some generations, not to others. And that is something that you discuss. You use the term cohort consciousness about how the younger generations seem to have more cohort consciousness and that it is fueled by technology and social media. You know, in addition to your work on generations and what you've done with this book, I was wondering if there's anything that you're working on now or that you hope to be working on soon, either related to this topic or to anything else.
Right. So most of my work is about social media. So the bridge topic for me was digital literacy, which I think is a very important topic. And, you know, it's analogous to literacy. It's the skills, the capacities that people have to navigate the internet and to use it in their desired ways and to not be deceived or fooled. And I think that there are obvious generational implications, but it's not deterministic in any sense. And in particular, younger generations are quite savvy at certain elements of using the internet, particularly the, you know, within platforms, et cetera. But there is a knowledge of the hardware that people, even in my generation, needed to have in order to navigate these technologies that is clearly being lost. And so studying the differential experiences of digital literacy by generation is something that I'm going to continue to work on. This also, I think, has huge implications for campaign finance. So an area which I only briefly mentioned in the book, but which I think is hugely important in American politics in particular, is campaign finance. And here, the donations by older people are so radically higher than younger people that this further amplifies their already significant advantage in politics. And this the connection between campaign finance and digital literacy is that I think increasingly political campaigns are designed primarily to defraud older people. So either literally to defraud them in the case of campaign contributions, which have to be given back because they have used deceptive marketing tactics. And we have all of these stories of, you know, grandchildren realizing that their quite elderly parents have donated all of their money to a political campaign, or in some cases donations are happening even after they pass away, is a significant problem for how political campaigns work. And I think that this is true in terms of informational content as well, that I think that reconstruing misinformation as a kind of informational fraud targeting the elderly is helpful to make the case for a kind of neo-paternalism and, you know, really taking seriously the challenges that are presented by delivering a iPad to someone who's never used the internet before and who lives by themselves in a nursing home is not empowering them. It is only opening them up to abuse and fraud.
That's a really fascinating framing, this idea that some campaigns are designed to defraud people with a little bit of extra money. You know, I'm thinking of Bannon's Wall in particular, which I'm sure is an example of that. But yeah, that sounds like a fascinating topic. And, you know, of course, extremely relevant. Campaign finance only becomes more relevant as the numbers skyrocket every single election. So Kevin, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was great speaking with you. The book is Generation Gap, Why the Baby Boomers Still Dominate American Politics and Culture, from Columbia University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.